Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Isaiah chapter 28, which I will call a cornerstone in Zion. This chapter is relatively easy because we know that Isaiah is prophesying against the northern tribe of Israel, which is going to be laid low by Shalmaneser V and Sargon II of Assyria in 722 BC. And then later on in the chapter, Judah, southern Israel, the southern two tribes, are laid bare by Babylon in 586 BC. So we begin now in verses 1 through 4. Isaiah says, "Woe to that wreath, the pride of Ephraim's drunkards, to the fading flower, his glorious beauty set on the head of a fertile valley, to that city, the pride of those laid low by wine. See, the Lord has one who is powerful and strong, like a hailstorm and a destructive wind, like a driving rain and a flooding downpour. He will throw it forcefully to the ground. That wreath, the pride of Ephraim's drunkards, will be trampled underfoot. That fading flower, his glorious beauty, set on the head of a fertile valley, will be like a fig ripe before the harvest. As soon as someone sees it and takes it in his hand, he swallows it." Now in verse 1, Isaiah says, "Woe." As Adam Clark says, that's because of the approaching doom of Shalmaneser V in 722 BC. Ephraim, of course, is the largest tribe of the northern 10 tribes of northern Israel. Samaria was the capital of Ephraim. Now, Ephraim's drunkards, the leaders of Ephraim of northern Israel, are said to have a wreath upon which woe is pronounced. Now, what is that wreath? KJV has crown, by the way. Here's the options. Option number one, the wreath refers to the great affluence and riches and numbers of people that Ephraim had, all of which were superior to the tribes of Judah and Benjamin. So, woe to you, Ephraim, who has a wreath of great affluence and riches and numbers of people. You're a fading flower. It's all going to go bye-bye. That's one option. Option number two, the wreath of Ephraim is the capital city, Samaria. This is held, too, by Clark and Jameson, Fawcett and Brown. In the KJV, it's called the crown of pride. I really think that's probably who Isaiah is talking about here. So, woe to Samaria. You're going down. The pride of Ephraim's drunkards. Now, this is an appropriate thing to call Ephraim because the inhabitants of Samaria and the places adjacent to Samaria were especially addicted to wine, to drunkenness. Those places abounded with excellent wines, and Sichem was nearby, and Sichem actually means drunkard. Nearby Sichem is thought to be called from the drunkenness of its inhabitants, Sychar, as Gill says. You recall that's where Jesus met the Samaritan woman, John 4:5. So he, Jesus, came to a town of Samaria called Sychar. Drunkenness, the literal definition of Sychar is drunkenness. This is from quotecosmos.com. So Ephraim's leaders, northern Israel's leaders, the last one of which was Hoshea when Shalmaneser V came in and Sargon II finished off Hoshea. These drunkards are leading northern Israel. Now they are said to have a city, the wreath, Samaria, which is a fading flower. Its glorious beauty is set on the head of a fertile valley. What does that mean? Well, just like flowers on a hill at the head of a valley, very beautiful. Likewise, Samaria would be at the head of a fertile valley, very beautiful. But those flowers are going to be fading, as Isaiah says. Now, it was the custom in drunken feasts to put a wreath of flowers on the head, just like flowers on a hill at the head of a valley. That might be the reference there also. I wouldn't be surprised if that's exactly what Isaiah is referring to. At any rate, that city, which I take to be the wreath, Samaria, the pride of those laid low by wine. The people who are drunk feel proud in that city, Samaria, but they are laid low because of their drunkenness. Verse 2, "See, the Lord has one who is powerful and strong." And that, of course, is Shalmaneser V, as Barnes and Benson say, and as Colin Dillich say also. Colin Dillich also mentioned Sargon II, who finished the siege. This happened in 722. Barnes quotes 2 Kings 17:3-6 in favor of this, and I'll read that to you. "Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, attacked him, and Hoshea became his vassal and paid him tribute money." This is a big deal in the history of northern Israel. 722 BC, we need to have that date implanted upon our brains, seared into it as with a brand. "But the king of Assyria discovered Hoshea's conspiracy. He had sent envoys to So, king of Egypt, and had not paid tribute money to the king of Assyria as in previous years." Hoshea had done that. tried to ally himself with Egypt. Therefore, the king of Assyria arrested him and put him in prison. Then the king of Assyria invaded the whole land, marched up to Samaria, and besieged it for 3 years. In the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria. That's 722. He deported the Israelites to Assyria and settled them in Halah and Bella-Habor. Those are rivers next to that run into the Tigris River, if I remember correctly, Gozan's River, and the cities of the Medes. So this is well attested in history. And so Isaiah is predicting it. He says that the Lord has one who is powerful and strong. That would be Shalmaneser V, who of course was powerful and strong. Like a hailstorm and a destructive wind, like a driving rain and a flooding downpour, he will throw it forcefully to the ground. That's the wreath that gets thrown to the ground. And if the wreath is Samaria, the capital city of Ephraim, it was thrown to the ground when it got besieged and overtaken. Of course, if the wreath is merely the abundance of population and wealth, and that got thrown down to the ground too, so it works either way. Verse 4, that fading flower, again, Samaria and the surrounding area, his glorious beauty set on the head of a fertile valley will be like a fig ripe before harvest. So think about flowers on the head of a drunk, or you can think about a city at the head of a fertile valley, flowers being set there at the head of the valley, like that beautiful city is set at the head of the valley. That city will be like a fig right before harvest. As soon as someone sees it and takes it in his hand, he swallows it. So the city might be beautiful, but Salmaneser V is going to think it's beautiful too, and Sargon II, they're going to come in, they're going to pluck it. They're going to eat the fig. They're going to destroy Samaria. We go now to Isaiah 28, verses 5 through 8. In that day, the Lord Almighty will be a glorious crown, a beautiful wreath for the remnant of his people. He will be a spirit of justice to him who sits in judgment, a source of strength to those who turn back the battle at the gate. And these also stagger from wine and reel from beer. Priests and prophets stagger from beer and are befuddled with wine. They reel from beer. They stagger when seeing visions. They stumble when rendering decisions. All the tables are covered with vomit, and there is not a spot without filth. Sounds like a fraternity beer bust. Now in verse 5, God himself is a glorious wreath for the remnant of his people. Now the remnant of his people are the two tribes that are left after the 10 northern tribes are taken off by the Assyrians in 722. The remnant of his people are the two southern tribes of Judah and Benjamin. Now, Clark, Benson, Barnes, Poole, and Pulpit all say that. That's a pretty strong majority of my commentators. And so, in contrast to the wreath that gets trampled down in the ground in the first four verses, Samaria, capital of the northern kingdom, located in some Ephraim, in contrast to that wreath, which got trampled down, God is going to give a glorious, beautiful wreath that's going to be placed on the heads of Judah and Benjamin in the south, the southern kingdom of Judah. Now, there's another possible way you can look at that. You can say, well, the beautiful wreath is going to refer to the crown of righteousness that's going to be put on those who were left after the Assyrians carried most of the population away from northern Israel. I don't believe that. Colin Delitzsch says it's both the righteous that were left in Samaria and the righteous who are in the southern two kingdoms of Judah and Benjamin, and the righteousness of the people in the southern two tribes of Judah and Benjamin. I think it's just as easy to say the remnant is Judah, the southern kingdom of Judah, consisting of the two tribes of Judah and Benjamin. In verse 6, God will be a spirit of justice to him who sits in judgment. In other words, God's going to give the judges of Judah wisdom so they can judge properly. He's going to be a source of strength to those who turn back the battle at the gate. In other words, anybody that attacks Jerusalem, he's going to give them strength to overcome the enemy. Now, does that refer to a particular battle against the gate? Matthew Poole thinks it does. He cites 2 Kings 18:8. He, referring to Hezekiah, who ruled from 716 to 687, Hezekiah defeated the Philistines as far as Gaza and its borders. Hezekiah defeated the Philistines as far as Gaza and its borders, from watchtower to fortified city. Now, I'm thinking that Isaiah could be referring to the fact that Hezekiah turned back Sennacherib in 701 B.C. None of my commentators mentioned that, though. I don't know whether that's a coincidence. That's strange. I would have thought that at least one of them would have mentioned that, but they didn't. But at any rate, God's going to give strength to the people in Judah to fight off their enemies. But then, here comes the bad news in verse 7. And these, the remnant in Judah, also stagger, also just like the drunkards up in the northern kingdom in Samaria, the leaders of the southern kingdom will stagger from wine. They'll be just as drunk and they'll reel from beer. I mentioned the leaders. Isaiah doesn't mention the political leaders. He does mention the priests and the prophets. They're all going around, staggering around, drunk, befuddled with wine, reeling with beer, staggering around when they see visions. And they stumble when rendering decisions. So that sounds like judges, magistrates, leaders. So no prophecy, no wise judgments. All the tables are covered with vomit. That's because when you get drunk, you throw up. There's not a spot without filth. That filth could be the vomit that's just referred to in verse 8. It could be some other kind of filth. One of my commentators said it was excrement, but I don't think so. I think it's drunken vomit. So it didn't take long for Judah and Benjamin to turn away from God. They turned away from God at the end of Hezekiah's reign and during Manasseh's reign. Manasseh was a very evil king. And then, of course, right before the Babylonian captivity, they were evil again and the Babylonians got them. So Isaiah is prophesying now judgment on the southern kingdom. So he starts out in the first four verses talking about judgment on the northern kingdom, and now he has turned to judgment on the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom getting wiped out by Assyria 722 and the southern kingdom getting wiped out by Babylon in 586 BC. We go down to Isaiah 28 verses 9 through 13. Who is it he is trying to teach? To whom is he explaining his message? To children weaned from their milk, to those just taken from the breast? For it is do and do, do and do, rule on rule, rule on rule, a little here, a little there. Very well then, with foreign lips and strange tongues, God will speak to this people, to whom he said, this is the resting place, let the weary rest, and this is the place of repose. But they would not listen. So then the word of the Lord to them will become, do and do, do and do, rule on rule, rule on rule, a little here, a little there, so that they will go and fall backward, be injured and snared and captured. Now, these five verses on first blush are not easy to interpret, but once we figure out just a couple of things here, it won't be hard to see. First of all, we read in verse 9, who is it he is trying to teach? The he, there are two options as to who that he might be, but the people being taught, it's very clear, it's the drunken people of Judah. Isaiah 28:14 in this same chapter tells us that. The very next verse after our passage, it says, therefore, hear the word of the Lord, O scoffers, who rule this people who are in Jerusalem. So it's the rulers in Jerusalem that are being taught. So that's easy. John Gill says, this phrase, who is he trying to teach, intimates the stupidity and sottishness of the Jews, whose minds were so impaired by excessive drinking that they were not able to take in the knowledge of these things. Okay, no problem there. But now the next problem is, who is the he that's trying to teach these drunken Jews? Let me give you three options, which basically collapse to two options. The first option is, this is a quotation of Isaiah of the drunken prophets of Judah who are mocking Isaiah. And these drunken prophets are complaining that Isaiah is treating the drunken prophets like children. So it would read like this. Who is this guy Isaiah trying to teach us? To whom is Isaiah explaining his message? To children weaned from their milk? We're not children. We're the big shot prophets of Judah. To those just taken for the breast? We're not little babies who've just been weaned. So Isaiah, this is what you're saying to us. Do and do, do and do, rule on rule, rule on rule. You're teaching us like little children. That's what you do. You break down a child's lesson into little tiny bits so that his little child brain can understand what you're saying, and that's how you're prophesying to us. A little here, a little there. And I think that's the way to interpret it. I'm not alone in that. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of my commentators who say that's definitely what it is, and I've got only two commentators who say it's the other option, which is that it's Isaiah speaking, or God speaking through Isaiah. If so, we read it this way. Isaiah says, who is it that God is trying to teach? To whom is God explaining his message? To children, these drunken prophets of Judah. They're children. They're weaned from their milk. They're just taken from their breast. They're children. For I've got to teach them this way. Do and do, do and do, rule on rule, rule on rule, a little here and a little there. That actually makes perfectly good sense if you want to take it that way. It's ironic that most of my commentators don't take it that way. They say it's Isaiah quoting the drunken prophets who are mocking Isaiah. Now, I said there were three options. One option could be, who is it that he, Isaiah, is trying to teach? Isaiah would be referring to himself in the third person. But that's the same thing as saying, who is God trying to teach? So we'll just take that as one option. The other option is the drunken prophets who are speaking, not the good guys. Well, that's the end of the quote. If it's the drunken prophets making fun of Isaiah, Isaiah's quoting them in verses 9 and 10. If that's the way we take it, remember the quotation marks are not in the original text. We therefore end the quotation there at the end of verse 10, and Isaiah begins to speak in his own voice in verse 11. Very well, then, Isaiah says, with foreign lips and strange tongues God will speak to this people. Now, the foreign lips and strange tongues are the language of the Babylonians, which language the Israelites, the Judahites, don't understand. And so basically what Isaiah is saying here, okay, I've been trying to teach you God's word with simple childlike language, and you don't listen. You can't even take in what a child could take in because you're so drunk. Your brain is as small as a child's brain. Well, okay, so you don't understand what I'm saying? Well, let's see if you understand what the Babylonians are going to say to you. You think you have trouble understanding what I'm saying? When you get destroyed by the Babylonians, then you'll understand. You'll understand even though it's not child language being spoken to you. It's adult language. Unfortunately, it'll be in a strange language. You don't know what it is, but it doesn't matter. You're still going to know what's happened because you just got wiped out. And the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, are looking at you in the face as they throw you in jail, rape your wives, burn your cities down. Then you'll understand. God will speak to the people then at the end of verse 11. This same God in verse 12 to whom he formerly said, this is the resting place, let the weary rest. In other words, in my arms you could have rested in me, Israel, Judah, but you didn't do it. And this is the place of repose, but you didn't do it, Judah. They would not listen, Isaiah says at the end of verse 12. So in verse 13, Isaiah continues, so then the word of the Lord to them will become do and do, do and do, rule on rule, rule on rule, a little here, a little there. That's the exact repetition. And so God will say, okay, I was speaking to you as a child. Well, I'm going to speak to you as a child again. And here's what's going to happen. You're going to fall backward, be injured, snared, and captured because the Babylonians are going to get you. So I'm still going to teach you like children, but you'll understand. You'll understand when you get wiped out. This is a lot of sarcasm here. I love these people who say that the Bible doesn't have sarcasm in it. The Bible is full of sarcasm. Isaiah is one tough dude, boy. He doesn't mince his words. Now, let me give you a quote from Barnes backing up this view that this phrase, do and do, do and do, rule on rule, a little here, a little there, is designed to describe drunk prophets mocking the true prophets or mocking Isaiah. Here's what Barnes says. This is probably designed to ridicule the concise and sententious manner of the prophets. Remember in verse 10, if you take verse 10 as referring to the words of the drunken prophets, they're saying, do and do. They're making fun of Isaiah. And Barnes backs that up. Let me read his quote again. He says, this is probably designed to ridicule the concise and sententious manner of the prophets, and especially the fact that they dwelt much upon the same elementary truths of religion. In other words, they go on over and over and over it again. In teaching children, we are obliged to do it by often repeating the same simple lesson. Of course, the drunken Judahites weren't interested in hearing the lesson, and so God and Isaiah had to repeat that lesson over and over again. Do and do, do and do, do and do. The Hebrew, by the way, there is sav la sav, sav la sav, kav la kav, kav la kav, which the NIV note says are probably meaningless sounds, perhaps a mimicking of the prophet's words, as I just said, and as Barnes just said. Now, of course, we need to remember that it could be that Isaiah is mocking the drunken prophets the other way around. If you take verses 9 and 10 to be stated by Isaiah straight and not Isaiah quoting the drunken prophets, if so, then Isaiah will be saying, this is the way it is. Do and do, do and do, rule on rule, rule on rule. This is the way I've got to teach you, you dumb clucks, you dumb drunken clucks. Either way, Isaiah's letting them hold it. Now in verse 11, Isaiah says that the people of Judah are going to be talked to by a people of foreign lips and strange tongues. The analogy is referring to the Babylonians, whose speech was different than the Hebrew of the Jews. Now, this is something I never thought about before. This is from Joseph Benson. He says, it was a great aggravation of the misery of the Jews during their captivity that they did not understand the language of the Chaldeans, the Babylonians. That would be a problem. You're taken prisoner and you can't understand what the guards are saying about you. Now this verse, Isaiah 28 verse 11, is quoted by Paul concerning glossolalia in 1 Corinthians 14:21. Paul says this, it is written in the law, i.e. in Isaiah. Isaiah is not part of the law, but that's what they would do back then. They would quote law, standing for law, prophets, and writing in the Old Testament. So it was written in the Old Testament. I will speak to these people by people of other languages and by the lips of foreigners, and even then they will not listen to me, says the Lord. Now, for years, I wondered about that quotation. I struggled over it when I was in college, and I said, what does this mean? I knew what Paul meant by speaking in tongues, and somebody told me what Isaiah meant, but they didn't seem to have anything to do with each other. Well, Paul's point was indeed not the same as Isaiah's point. They had two different purposes, these two writers did. Paul had this purpose. He wanted to say this, there should be no tongues in church without interpretation. Isaiah's purpose was this, Jerusalem is going down to the Babylonians. Those two things have nothing to do with each other. But Paul, as I have later discovered, and as many, many New Testament writers do, Paul and New Testament writers take the Old Testament out of context, use a phrase in order to make their point in the New Testament. That's the way they did things back then. We've got to get used to it. We don't do that today. As a college professor, I'm very sensitive to doing that today. And so, because I didn't adapt to the cultural context of the way things were back in Paul's time, I got balled up by that. I was trying to find a common meaning between the Old and New Testament citations there, and you can't do it because there is no common meaning. In verse 13, Isaiah continues, the word of the Lord to them, to the Judahites, will become do and do, rule on rule, a little here, a little there. That's the exact repetition of verse 10, when, on my interpretation, the drunken prophets were mocking Isaiah by saying that, and then Isaiah turns around and guess what God's going to say to you? Do and do, rule and rule, rule and rule, just like you were mocking me with. Well, God's going to do it to you too. He's going to be speaking to you as one would speak to a child. And the message will be very simple. The Babylonians are going to destroy you. And then you're going to fall backwards, be injured, ensnared, and captured. Now, I said that phrase a little here, a little there was part of that long phrase, which means I'm going to speak baby talk to you, keeping it simple so that you will understand. Well, that's one option, but one of my commentators sees a little more in that, Barnes. He says a little here and a little there refers to the fact that the judgment from Babylon will be gradual. As Barnes says, it shall not come in one sudden and overpowering burst of indignation, but it shall be, as it were, dealt out to them in small portions that it may not be soon exhausted. Well, I read that and I thought, well, the Babylonians' destruction of Jerusalem didn't seem gradual to me. But if you consider the fact that Babylon three times deported Jews from Judah to Babylon, in 605 Daniel went, and in 597 there was a national deportation, and 586 was the destruction of Jerusalem and the final deportation, that was sort of gradual. But I'm not sure that's what Isaiah was referring to. I think that little on little means you're drunk, leaders of Judah, and as a result, I've got to speak to you like a little kid, a little here, a little there. We go now to Isaiah 28, verses 14 through 15. Therefore, hear the word of the Lord, you scoffers who rule this people in Jerusalem. You boast, we have entered into a covenant with death, with the grave we have made an agreement. When an overwhelming scourge sweeps by, it cannot touch us, for we have made a lie our refuge and falsehood our hiding place. Now, in verse 14, therefore hear the word of the Lord, you scoffers who rule this people in Jerusalem. We have already said that verse ties down whom Isaiah is prophesying against the rulers of Judah, because Jerusalem's the capital of Judah. Now, John Gill says this must not be understood of the chief ruler, Hezekiah, but rather of some subordinate rulers, such as Shebna and other people. These rulers in verse 15 boast, we have entered into a covenant with death, which sounds strange. It sounds like they've agreed to die, but that's not what it means. It means they have entered into a covenant with death that death would not kill them. In other words, we'll do something for you, death, if you do something for us. Stay away. So this phrase is expressive of their being fearless of death. It's kind of a proverbial expression, as Adam Clark says. Well, that's one option. Another way you can take it is this covenant of death is with their deadly, deathly enemies. And so these rulers have committed treason by making a covenant with Assyria or making a covenant with Babylon, with whoever the enemies are. At the time of Isaiah's prophesying, it would be Assyria. That's treason. Well, if that's so, then it would be true with the grave. We have made an agreement. We've agreed to die. We've killed Judah. I don't think that's what it is. I think it's the way Barnes and Poole have it. It's a covenant with death to leave us alone because we don't think we're going to die. Because the next phrase in verse 15 says, when an overwhelming scourge sweeps by, it cannot touch us. Same idea. For we have made a lie our refuge and falsehood our hiding place. So these people are thinking that their lies and their falsehoods are going to save them from the disaster that's coming. Now, the drunken false prophets and priests might not have admitted that it was a lie that they had used to tell themselves or to tell the people, we're all right, that's not a problem. They might not have admitted to themselves that it was a lie. Isaiah is calling it a lie. We go down to Isaiah 28, verses 16 through 19. Isaiah continues, so this is what the sovereign Lord says. See, I lay a stone in Zion, a tested stone, a precious cornerstone for a sure foundation. The one who trusts will never be dismayed. I will make justice the measuring line and righteousness the plumb line. Hail will sweep away your refuge, the lie, and water will overflow your hiding place. Your covenant with death will be annulled. Your agreement with the grave will not stand. When the overwhelming scourge sweeps by, you will be beaten down by it. As often as it comes, it will carry you away, morning after morning, by day and by night, it will sweep through. The understanding of this message will bring sheer terror. The understanding when it happens, then they'll understand that Isaiah was telling the truth. And of course, that will be a terrible thing. Now, verse 16, Isaiah says that God says, see, I lay a stone in Zion, a tested stone. Here's what the pulpit commentary says about the stones that were laid in Zion as cornerstones for the temple. The imagery is, no doubt, drawn from the practice of Oriental kings, and notably Solomon, to employ foundation stones of enormous size and weight at the corners of buildings. Some of those uncovered at the corners of Solomon's temple by the Palestine Exploration Fund are more than 38 feet long and weigh above 100 tons. So we're talking about a large, large stone that's laid. It's a tested stone. Why was the stone itself tested? As Barnes says, for stability, firmness, and solidity, so the foundation would be secure. They're not going to just put any stone in the foundation. Now, who does the stone refer to? It could refer to God, option one, or the Messiah, option two. We're so used to hearing this verse quoted in the New Testament as referring to Jesus that we might tend to forget that Isaiah might have meant it to refer to God. So let's take that first. This is what the pulpit commentator said. Yahweh himself would seem to be the rock intended, and hence the application to Christ by the writers of the New Testament was natural and easy. But it may be questioned whether the passage was to Isaiah himself messianic or meant more than that God had set his name in his presence at Jerusalem from the time that the temple was built there and that it was a mistake to look elsewhere than to him for deliverance or security. In other words, Isaiah is talking about God, and the New Testament writers referred it to Jesus, but Isaiah didn't mean it to refer to Jesus at the time he prophesied. Of course, there's no way to answer that. I don't know. But if he was referring to the Messiah directly, we can at least look in the New Testament and see two places where Jesus is called a choice stone in Zion, a tested stone in Zion. Romans 9:33, Paul says, as it is written, i.e. in Isaiah, in our current verse, Isaiah 28:16, as it is written, look, I am putting a stone in Zion to stumble over a rock to trip over, yet the one who believes on him will not be put to shame. Obviously, Jesus is the stone in Zion. 1 Peter 2:6, for it is contained in Scripture, look, I lay a stone in Zion, a chosen and honored cornerstone, and the one who believes in him will never be put to shame. Now, Zion, of course, is the symbol of the New Testament church, Hebrews 12:22. We should never forget that. And so the stone is Jesus who's being put into the church. That's easy imagery. Now, Jesus is referred to as a stone in the Old Testament scripture, speaking prophetically. Psalms 118, verse 22, the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. That's referring to Jesus because he was rejected by the Jews. Daniel 2:45. You saw a stone break off from the mountain without a hand touching it, and it crushed the iron, bronze, fired clay, silver, and gold. Of course, that's the final of the four great kingdoms, the Roman Empire. The stone broke off from the mountain. That was the Christian church taking over the Roman Empire. The great God has told the king what will happen in the future. And so that stone that broke off from the mountain, that's referring to the Messiah, Jesus. Now in verse 17, Isaiah says, I will make justice the measuring line and righteousness the plumb line. A measuring line keeps the horizontal measurements of a building straight, and a plumb line keeps the vertical measurements of a building straight. So basically the idea is justice is going to keep everything straight in Israel, or the new Israel, the church, when Jesus is laid as a choice stone in Zion, the new Israel. Justice will be everywhere. Hail will sweep away your refuge, the lie that you drunken leaders of Judah relied in to say that you weren't going to be destroyed by Babylon. Well, hail, just like it destroys crops, is going to destroy you, and your refuge will be gone, and the Babylonians are going to get you. Water will overflow your hiding place. That's the Babylonians. They're going to get you. That refers to the armies of Babylon inundating Jerusalem. In verse 19, Isaiah says, as often as it comes, it will carry you away. The overwhelming scourge. As often as it comes, it will carry you away morning after morning. This probably refers to the frequent hostile invasions of Judah occurring after the deportation of the 10 tribes. Assyria came in, 701 under Sennacherib, and then, of course, we have the Babylonian invasions, 605, 598, 586. It's not going to stop. It's going to be unrelenting. You guys are going down, you drunken Judahites. We go down to verses 20 through 22. Isaiah continues, the bed is too short to stretch out on, the blanket too narrow to wrap around you. The Lord will rise up as he did at Mount Perazim. He will rouse himself as in the valley of Gibeon to do his work, his strange work, and perform his task, his alien task. Now stop your mocking, or your chains will become heavier. The Lord Almighty, has told me of the destruction decreed against the whole land. Now what does Isaiah mean? The bed is too short to stretch out on, and the blanket too narrow to wrap around you? That was a proverbial expression to show that one was uncomfortable. Having slept on a sofa for years in China where my feet stuck over the end of the sofa, I had to go to the sofa because the bed was so hard it was like sleeping on a concrete floor because the Chinese seemed to love boards to sleep on. I know what that means. So basically Isaiah is saying, people of Judah, you're going to be uncomfortable. Leaders of Judah, you're going to be miserable. Verse 21, the Lord will rise up as he did at Mount Perazim. When did the Lord rise up at Mount Perazim? Well, that's when the Lord broke forth on David's enemies, the Philistines, as recounted for us in 2 Samuel 5, verses 18 through 20. This is according to Barnes and Benson both. This is one option. Actually, it's the only option because of the strict name Perazim. It tells us exactly what's being referred to. Let me read that for you. 2 Samuel 5, 18 through 20. So the Philistines came and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. That's a valley somewhere running north and south at the north and west of Jerusalem. Then David inquired of the Lord, should I go to war against the Philistines? Will you hand them over to me? The Lord replied to David, go, for I will certainly hand the Philistines over to you. So David went to Baal Perazim. There's the name there, Baal Perazim. The Baal just means there were Baals there at Perazim. And David defeated the Philistines there and said, like a bursting flood, the Lord has burst out against my enemies before me. Therefore he named that place the Lord burst out. That's what Perazim means. It means to break through, to burst out. Jameson Foster and Brown says, in the valley of Rephaim, there Jehovah, that's Yahweh, by David broke forth as waters do and made a breach among the Philistines, David's enemies, as Perazim means, expressing a sudden and complete overthrow. So in verse 21, Isaiah is saying, God is going to wipe you out completely just like David did at Mount Perazim. God will rouse himself as in the valley of Gibeon. Now there's an option here as to what valley of Gibeon is being referred to. The best option, in my humble opinion, is what Albert Barnes says. This is referring to the same incident at Baal Perazim, because after that, the Philistines, having been clobbered, they returned and they went to Gibeon. We read that in 1 Chronicles 14:16. So David did exactly as God commanded him, and they struck down the Philistine army from Gibeon to Gezer. And so the Philistines got whacked again at Gibeon. So this is all referring to the same incident according to that view, and I believe it's true. There is another possibility, which Barnes denies, that this reference to Gibeon in Isaiah 28, verse 21, is referring to when Joshua wiped out the Canaanites at Gibeon. Remember, Gibeon is in the tribe of Benjamin, right to the northwest of Jerusalem, a few miles. Joshua 10, verses 10 through 13, the Lord threw them into confusion before Israel. He defeated them in a great slaughter, that's the Philistines, at Gibeon, chased them through the ascent of Beth-horon, and struck them down as far as Azekah and Makeda. It's not the Philistines, I'm sorry, it's the Canaanites. As they fled before Israel, the Lord threw large hailstones on them from the sky along the descent of Beth-horon all the way to Azekah, and they died. More of them died from the hail than the Israelites killed with the sword. On the day the Lord gave the Amorites over to Israelites, Joshua spoke to the Lord in the presence of Israel, "Sun, stand still over Gibeon." There's the reference to Gibeon. "And moon over the valley of Ajalon." And the sun stood still and the moon stopped until the nation took vengeance on its enemies. But that's a minority opinion. Probably talking about when God whacked the Philistines at Perazim and in the valley of Gibeon. The point of the analogy is, God is going to thoroughly destroy you, Judah. He's going to do his work. In verse 21, his strange work. Now, why is God's destruction of the Jews called a strange work? Well, the overwhelming majority opinion is that God usually fights for Israel, just like he did at Perazim and Gibeon, just mentioned. But in this case, he's going to fight against Israel, and that's a strange thing for the God of Israel to be fighting against Israel. Now, let me read you the commentators who agree with that view. Cambridge, Barnes, Benson, Ellicott, Colin Delitch, Pulpit, Poole, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown mention this option as an option. They don't necessarily affirm it, but that's an overwhelming majority of my commentators say that this is a strange work because it's strange that God would be fighting Israel. Now, there's another option that Gill, Poole, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown mention as an option, but not with definite certainty, is that this could be a strange work because this was a work, an act of strict justice and awful severity. In other words, normally God is agreeable and shows mercy, grace, and goodness, and he delights in that, but now he's being very, very strict. And in fact, I've heard a lot of preachers talk about strange works of God, the strange work of God. He doesn't like to whack people in judgment. Well, that might be so from another verse somewhere, which I'm not familiar with yet, but right here, I think it just means God is judging his people rather than blessing his people, which is what he normally does. Another third option is that God's work was a strange work because it was unusual and extraordinary and marvelous and surprising because it was an amazing thing to see Jerusalem burnt, that wonder of the ancient world, to be burnt down by the Babylonians. In verse 22, Isaiah says, "Now stop your mocking or your chains will become heavier." You know, prophets didn't have it easy. People always making fun of them. That would have driven me crazy. I can't even stand it when people disagree with me on eschatology. I mean, I can stand it, actually. I force myself to. But, I mean, Isaiah, he got dumped on. All the prophets did. Mocking. And Isaiah says, go ahead and mock, but if you keep doing that, your chains will become heavier. In other words, your exile is going to be worse. "Because the Lord Almighty, has told me of the destruction decreed against the whole land." Of course, that's the whole land of Israel. Now, of course, you can always translate Eretz as earth. As a matter of fact, I found four translations that do so. The ESV, the KJV, the New American Bible, and the New American Standard Bible. That's not what it is. I don't believe that. He's talking about the destruction against the whole land of Judah after the Babylonians whip up on them. Here are translations that translate that as land. NIV, Holman Christian Study Bible, Bible in Basic English, Darby, God's Word, and Young's Literal Translation. That's the way it is, folks. It's land. We go now to verses 23 through 29, and we will finish this chapter. Isaiah continues, "Listen and hear my voice. Pay attention and hear what I say. When a farmer plows for planting, does he plow continually? Does he keep on breaking up and harrowing the soil? When he has leveled the surface, does he not sow caraway and scatter cumin? Does he not plant wheat in its place, barley in its plot, and spelt in its field? His God instructs him and teaches him the right way. Caraway is not threshed with a sledge, nor is a cartwheel rolled over cumin. Caraway is beaten out with a rod, and cumin with a stick. Grain must be ground to make bread, so one does not go on threshing it forever. Though he drives the wheels of his threshing cart over it, his horses do not grind it. All this also comes from the Lord Almighty, wonderful in counsel and magnificent in wisdom." Now, Isaiah is speaking to an agricultural people, of which I'm not. He's speaking to an ancient people, which I am not, and so I don't understand any of this agricultural stuff, or I didn't. So we're going to look at it at least superficially and get the main idea out of it. First of all, in verse 24, Isaiah says, when a farmer plows for planting, does he plow continually? In other words, he's saying God will not continue to threaten judgment. Sooner or later, he's going to execute judgment. A farmer doesn't keep on planting, 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 not expecting a harvest. Well, God's not going to keep on threatening, threatening, threatening judgment without actually carrying it out shortly. In verse 25, Isaiah says, when he has leveled the surface, when the farmer has done that, does he not sow caraway? Caraway, according to Oxford Languages Dictionary, is, quote, the seeds of a plant of the parsley family used for flavoring and as a source of oil. Does not, and of course, who knows whether that's translated right? I don't think any translator knows what plants are in ancient Hebrew times. Does not the farmer scatter cumin? Now, the Holman Christian Study Bible there has black cumin with one M. The NIV has cumin with two M's. So I don't think anybody knows. Cumin with two M's, according to BibleStudyTools.com, is one of the cultivated plants of Palestine. It is an umbelliferous plant, something like fennel. Not really describes it, does it not? Umbelliferous, whatever the heck that means. The seeds have a bitterish, warm taste and an aromatic flavor. It doesn't matter what they are. The point is, when the farmer plants, he plants the way he wants to plant. And he plants his grain in the right place. Does he not plant wheat in its place? Barley in its plot and spelt, that's another kind of grain, in its field? In other words, the farmer farms properly. This is a metaphor referring to the fact that God executes proper divine judgment. Each nation is proportionally judged for their sins. Now, this is not my idea. This is from Gill, Clark, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. I think they're right, each in its place. The farmer plants, God will likewise judge properly. Verse 27, caraway is not threshed with a sledge. To thresh means to separate the grain from the stalk. A sledge was a big, heavy board with iron stakes coming out the bottom of it. The board had wheels. I assume it was four wheels. And then the stones were put on top of the board to drive the iron spikes down into the grain that was being threshed. But Isaiah says, caraway's not done that way. You beat it. You don't sledge it. Nor is a cartwheel rollover coming. Likewise, you beat that with a stick. You beat caraway with a rod coming with a stick. I think rod and stick are the same thing. But basically, the idea is you don't so heavily try to thresh your grain or your spices or whatever the heck this stuff is. You don't do that. Why? Well, let's keep going. Verse 28, grain must be ground to make bread, so one does not go on threshing it forever. In other words, you keep on running a sledge over wheat, pretty soon you'll crush all the grains of wheat that have been separated from the wheat plant. You keep on driving your sledge over it, and pretty soon you'll crush the wheat grains, and they'll be worthless. You can't make bread out of it anymore. At the end of verse 28, though he, the farmer, drives the wheels of his threshing cart over it, over the grain, his horses do not grind it. Now, of course, the threshing cart is not driven over the caraway and cumin, but if you have wheat, you drive a threshing cart over it, but you don't then walk over it with your horses to grind it down because you'll destroy it. Now, what's the point of all this? The point is very simple. God does not destroy the people of Israel with his judgments. He'll chastise them mightily, but they're not going to be destroyed. In fact, the nation of Israel came back from Babylon. The Jewish kingdom then was established. The Messiah was born. And again, the Jewish kingdom was destroyed in AD 70. But the spiritual Israel, the new Israel, was formed in the shape of the church. And the church is worldwide now, not just localized. And the church can handle Gentiles and Jews if they will believe. So that's what the point of all this agricultural imagery is. God's going to whack Jerusalem, but he's not going to destroy it. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Isaiah chapter 28, and we are prepared now to go to Isaiah 29, which I will call the Siege of Jerusalem. This is the great event of 586 BC. I hope you stay tuned to explore that with me, and I hope you enjoy this audio.